Since he also brings with him, as I said, high literary skills and science and technology, etc. So his articles were more well known and highly appreciated, just for the not just the business that is published in Business India, but also the way he wrote extensively on science and technology and so on. Of course, he was awarded Madhu Valluri Award during this time. He also wrote two very highly popular books. One is, of course, Hand to Silicon, The Amazing Story of Digital Technology, which he published in 2006, which was very, very well appreciated by the communities across science and technology, IT, business, and so on. And followed by another book on research, innovation, and TCS. I will shortly tell the connection to the TCS in 2007, which was actually released by Dr. Abdul Kalam, right? Is that right? Okay. And coming to the connection to TCS, he was vice president for the special projects of TCS between 2004 and 2010. As many of you know, CMC Limited, which is also part of TCS, he was global head for marketing and strategic communication. So he comes with several hats. So I think he's a very versatile speaker, technologist, a physicist, a business person, a business writer. So we're all looking forward to your very exciting colloquium. Thank you.
Okay, yeah. Yeah, okay, great. Yeah. Thanks. Hello. Yeah. Thank you, Dr. Satyanarayana, for that kind introduction. You have to bear with me. I have just spent 4 days in Delhi and my throat is badly infected. Excuse me. So I'll keep interrupting myself. And I couldn't miss this commitment, so I pumped myself with antibiotics and steroids, and hopefully I'll make it through the next hour or so. I'm very happy to have Harish also here, who kindly dropped in. Harish Mehta, as he already said, is one of the pioneers of IT in India, and he is one of the founders of NASSCOM, which is a probably the most successful industry lobby, and which has made the word lobby respectable. Yeah, and Dr. Satyanarayana, of course, is a bundle of energy, and all these years he was hidden in the Kolar goldfields, I think, because after doing all these things in TIFR, all the time he's busy running in or out of a meeting, and then he still finds the time to go to some rural college or Mofusil college and give lectures on IEEE and evangelize for IEEE. Very happy to be here. I couldn't miss this. Okay, now I have given this talk, probably this is the 30th or 40th lecture I am giving on this topic. The reason is the content as it will unfold, you will see, is not known to many people. That most people think digital technology means IT and IT means software, and then they, you know a couple of Indian IT companies' names and they say, oh, that, okay. So then what is it that we have done in the at the fundamental level in these areas? So whereas we had done actually when I was in Business India, we did in year 2000, when there was a big explosion in the internet companies and so on, and they made a big splash on Wall Street, we did a special issue called profiling Indian entrepreneurs who had done well in Silicon Valley. In fact, this was the title of that, How Indians Won the Silicon Valley. Okay, but that was more on the business side of it. And it was extremely successful. Four of us went to US, traveled around for a month and a half. And Silicon Valley, as you know, is just a metaphor. We traveled all over the East Coast and West Coast and tried to identify these successful entrepreneurs, and we profiled about 70 of them. And that was a surprise to many, that there were so many. Otherwise, they had heard 2-3 names, Kanwal Rekhi and Vinod Khosla and Sabir Bhatia. Those were the 3 names which are around at that time. And we discovered about 70 of them. And then later, that issue was very well received by everybody, both here and abroad. And a senior executive from Tata Group, Mr. Gopalakrishnan actually, he sent a mail to me saying, oh, it's all very nice, good, feel-good stories, but what about Indian contribution to fundamental technology? You know, what have they done? So I took up that challenge with him. A year later, I sent a project proposal to him saying, look, but this will require a lot of primary research. There is no book written on this or anything connected to this even. So how do I put it across to lay audience? With normally a journalist like that, suppose you know you want to write a popular physics book, then you have enough physics material to bank on. But in this case, we had to do primary research as well, and actually trace both the evolution of global digital technology as well as find what Indians have done, what have been significant contributions by Indians in the broader sense, both in India and abroad. People of Indian origin, and Tata's very generously came forward to fund that project. So Tata Sons took it up as one of the projects for their centenary in 2004. So I did most of the research in 2002 for this. I took a year and a half sabbatical from Business India and did the research for this. So I ended up interviewing more than 200 technologists all over the world, mostly in the United States and Canada and India, you know, and all the major campuses, and even industrial R&D, Bell Labs, IBM Research, TI, Intel, you know, all the major tech companies as well as universities. I have about 157 CDs full of audio interviews, technical audio interviews. We had to do a lot of scan, patent scan, IEEE transactions, IEEE fellowships, ACM fellowships, all the awards, because how do you prepare a short list of people who have done significant work? So it has to be peer recognized. So we had to go by fellowships and awards, and even we did some sort of a Oscar type of polling, saying who do you choose as that, you know, guys who have done the significant work. We sent that questionnaire to about 350 people and so on and so forth. Anyway, as a result of that, I mean, I am just going to maybe talk just a couple of minutes per person, about 35-40 of them. I'm sure I have left out a few, but these are representative. And you'll come to know the breadth of the contribution from, you know, in all these fields. Now, okay, I mean, this is the reference. One of the things is the book which he already mentioned, Science of Silicon. That was published by Tata McGraw-Hill in 2004. It has repeated. The paperback edition has been published by Rupa. And I think even that is out of print. So I have put the PDF copy on the net. Anybody can download it. This is an article I wrote recently, 65 Years of Computer Science in India to Rediff. That's available on my blog. 65 years being also the day when TIFRAC was done right here in TIFR. And this is a research paper sort of thing I had written on what has been Indian contribution really to software services. Okay, that how did they move an artisan type activity to an industrial activity, something literally like what Henry Ford and Toyota did to manufacturing. And that is the real contribution. That is what is disruptive about Indian IT services as compared to the what existed before that. And these are other two references which are very well worth reading. One is written by Katie Hafner, who writes quite often in New York Times. And this is a book written by her on the history of internet, ARPANET to internet, very well written. And this by Mitchell Waldrop, who is also a physicist who has become a journalist. I think now he's editor of, he used to be in Nature, now I think he's editor, one of the editors of Science. And this Dream Machine, JCR Licklider and the Revolution That Made Computing Personal, is extremely readable book, gives you the history of computing from Leibniz, Boole, etc. to Babbage and current computing, and also the evolution of ARPANET, internet, and then the personal computing revolution that started in Xerox PARC and then became IBM PC and Apple, etc. Very well written books. Anyway, so now before I come to 19th century, 20th century, etc., let me go back a little bit to some of the foundational contributions from India. I won't say much, you're all science, physics, engineering background people, so the importance of zero to the whole arithmetic evolution and the place value system of numbers. And without this, we couldn't have carried on adding in a simple way. So literally, Ganit is what we called mathematics, not the Greek mathematics, which was more metaphysical. Ganit actually meant counting. And counting and writing numbers and numbers in place value system, which is actually a binomial coefficients to the base 10, right? 343 means 3 to the 10 to the power 2, 4 into 10 to the power 1, 3 into 10 to the power 0. So 3, 4, 3 are the coefficients. And with a carryover system, you very easily add. And addition is the first step in arithmetic, and then all that the computers, all that the computers can really do is add. Everything is addition. And this is what Pierre Laplace said about this contribution. He said it is Hindus that gave us the ingenious method of expressing all numbers by means of 10 symbols, each symbol receiving a value of position as well as an absolute value, an important and profound idea which appears so simple that we ignore its true merit. Okay, then few more. Aryabhatta and Brahmagupta and Bhaskara, the two Bhaskaras, but particularly Aryabhatta, Brahmagupta, and the Bhaskara who came along with Brahmagupta, Bhaskara I, they enunciated a whole method of calculating also. And it is this method was new, step-by-step approach, what today we call algorithmic approach, was actually created by these gentlemen. And it is this which was understood by Al-Khwarizmi, the Arabic Persian mathematician, and he wrote two important books, one on the Hindu method of reckoning, that is Hindu mathematics, where he introduced a decimal system, and the other one was this, Al-Kitab Al-Mukhtasar Fi Hisab Al-Jabr Wal-Muqabala. This is how to solve equations, how to balance equations, right? RHS, LHS, right? And that was very novel. And this, of course, later when the church set up a translation factory in Toledo in Spain, they translated a lot of Arabic texts because they found, Arabs very advanced. After the Crusades, they found they were technologically advanced, they knew mathematics, astronomy, chemistry, so many things. And the Arabs were voracious readers. They read Indian texts, they learned from the Chinese, they learned from the Greeks, and they developed on their own also. And at the same time, they were quite, you can say, honest. They didn't plagiarize, and they acknowledged what they learned from whom. So they were very happy to say, we learned this from Indians, etc., etc. Okay? That is a quality which you have not found very easily in the Europeans. Now, when the Europeans translated this text into Latin, they left out this long title and just retained this and called it algebra. Al-Jabr became algebra. And since Al-Khwarizmi had written this. So they called it algorithmus, and today we call it algorithm. Then we have continuation of this tradition with Madhava, Nilakanta Somayaji and Jayashadeva, who wrote in Malayalam and in Sanskrit, and they wrote infinite series expansions of various functions, sin x, arctan x, all kinds of things, and which 200 years later with Newton and Leibniz calculus, and then we write down Taylor series, Maclaurin series and all this of various functions as a infinite series. So many of these series were written down by these people in 14th to 16th century. And the interesting thing in this is that in the summation, it is a converging sums, many of them, and you can stop at whichever place you want depending on the accuracy you want. So if you are calculating pi, if you are happy with 3.14, fine, you can stop there. If you want the next decimal place, etc., then you say 3.15939 or whatever. Okay, 959 13959, whatever. So you can stop at depending on where, you know, what is the accuracy you need, which decimal place you want to stop. After all, it's an irrational number, it can go on infinitely, right? So that brings us also to this concept that you can stop somewhere depending on the accuracy you need. So this is a fundamental principle in numerical methods, right? You stop after certain iterations because you keep certain error limits. And you call that, this is also what is called as zeroism. Okay, you take it to the nearest integer and stop it there. And you allow for that small error because it doesn't really matter. Anyway, so these are some of the, and even they have developed several numerical methods which we apply now. Later they were also called Newton-Raphson method and various other things in the numerical calculations. Because after all, analytical, we can solve analytically very few equations, at least in physics. That's why the famous thing is particle in a box and a two-body problem, right? And simple harmonic oscillator. That's why we keep repeating that. Those are the three solvable equations. Okay. Now I'll come to the more recent contributions. I have divided these 30-35 people into a few categories. The first is semiconductors and devices. And the first one is good old Jagdish Chandra Bose. Many of us know him. I've learnt about him as a person who discovered that plants can feel and may have a neural system, etc., right? But he has been rediscovered, sort of, by electrical engineers, microwave engineers, etc. And today he has been hailed for his contribution to semiconductor physics and for microwave engineering. And in fact, he's the first guy to ever patent a solid state device. This was in the 1896-97 period. When he went to demonstrate his apparatus, which could produce electromagnetic waves and receive it. So the receiver which he had made, which he called as iron mercury coherer, and he had used galena crystals. And so one American gentleman came to his hotel and said, you know, you should patent this. So Professor Bose said, no, I'm not interested, I don't even know what to do with it. But anyway, he later succumbed and it was patented. So you can say historically this is the first solid state device which was patented. And we come to know, as usual, about him when a European talks about him. So in 1978, Sir Neville Mott received the Nobel Prize for Semiconductor Physics. And he had done most of his work in the 50s. And in his Nobel lecture, you can go back and see it, he says there that Jagdish Chandra Bose was a pioneer and he was probably ahead of us by 60 years. That is, in the 1890s, he probably foresaw p-type and n-type semiconductors. Anyway, so clearly you can say first contribution to solid state devices. This is a more modern one, Jayant Balgar from IIT Madras. He was working in GE research. When he developed power transistors. Now, as you know, in most microelectronics, as you start shrinking transistors and circuits, originally the transistors was of this size when it was first invented in Bell Labs, a germanium one, and in fact Bell Labs didn't know what to do with it. So in the press conference, the Bell Labs spokesperson in 1948 said, "We don't know what is it good for. Maybe we'll use it in some hearing aid." Okay, so that is what happened 70 years ago. That is what you can. That's what happens when you try to forecast technology or impact of technology. In fact, same thing happened to Jack Kilby, who invented the chip, and when he showed it to his superiors in 1958-59 in Texas Instruments, they said, "Okay, this is very nice. What can we use it for?" Then he thought up, he said, "Maybe I can make a calculator." He said, "Okay, do it." And that's how the TI calculators became very, you know, useful for engineers and scientists earlier. But they couldn't think beyond that. And of course, when I met him, he had just received his Nobel Prize in 2000. He was given a physics Nobel Prize because that was the impact of the chip. Very rarely engineers get physics Nobel Prize, but he was given a physics Nobel Prize of the impact chip had. And he said, "I never knew it is going to, you know, affect our life so much." Anyway, so that trend in microelectronics has led to today, you know, a small chip having billions of transistors. Now, these billions of transistors working on 3 volts, 5 volts, you know, the small batteries you are carrying, lithium-ion batteries in your mobile phones or in your laptops, etc. So they have to consume very low power. So from amperes, you go down to milliamperes and microamperes. They consume low power and they produce less heat. So it assists mobility if you reduce the power consumption of a chip. But there are also applications where you need to deal with very high powers. Thousands of amperes, even millions of amperes. It is that kind of transistors which Balgar invented. They are called IGBT, integrated gate bipolar transistors. And today it's a multi-billion dollar industry. And they're mostly used in bullet trains, Shinkansen trains, even in medical defibrillators, which are used to, you know, revive you if your heart has stopped. They give you shocks. So they also use this kind of power transistors. Umesh Mishra, young fellow from IIT Kanpur, he's now at UC Santa Barbara, and he's doing cutting edge work in gallium nitride. And gallium nitride, you know, is a relatively new semiconductor. Mostly people have worked on gallium arsenide earlier, and earlier LEDs also were gallium arsenide LEDs, blue, red, and it was gallium nitride which led to blue LED and which has led to all the LED lighting now everywhere. But gallium nitride also has very high frequency, high power applications, and that's what he is exploring, which is required in telecom and defense and other applications. Chips and microelectronics. Okay, Pallab Chatterjee from IIT Kharagpur, he joined TI and did very good work in the actual chip industry, in the process. Into particularly, he was recognized for his work in what was called trenching, and later in the 80s he was also given an important responsibility by US government. Suddenly US government found that the Japanese companies were marching ahead of the US companies in chip industry. So it was not TI, Motorola, IBM, Intel, but the Japanese Toshiba and others were going ahead and were coming out with better and faster and chips, more powerful chips, etc. So how were they able to do it, and how were they able to sell it at a lower price than the American companies? This was a question. So it meant that the failure of the chip, see many times when you design a chip and cast it, after you cast it you find that maybe 50% are not working, are not providing the full functionality. So that is a loss, total loss. So that means something in their process is yielding better result. So a small committee was found with two people, Pallab Chatterjee and Professor Saraswat, VK Saraswat from Krishna Saraswat from Stanford University. They studied this problem. They were assigned by the US President's office and they studied this, and they were able to figure out how the Japanese had moved ahead. And those, because again these are all industrial secrets, so they had to sort of do forensic sort of analysis, and they were able to come up with the correct solution, and that's how again US industry went ahead. So Pallab has been recognized for that contribution as well. Okay, now comes to memory. This is Sanjay Mehrotra. Not many people know about him. Bits Pilani and then later moved to Berkeley. He did original work in what were earlier called EEPROMs, electronic programmable memories. Then it became E squared PROM, electronic erasable and programmable memories. And then later they led to flash memory, and so memory, and then later memory sticks. So he founded a company along with three others, which is now of course ubiquitous. It's called SanDisk. Okay, all of us use SanDisk thumb drives and sticks, memory sticks. And recently that company was sold for some $19 billion or something. Now he's took a year sabbatical, and now he's chairman of another very large company, $30 billion company, which again dominates the memory and hard disk space, called Micron Technologies. So he's now the CEO of that. But his contribution to the memory and hard disk and thumb drives is technologically also fundamental. He was the main designer of that. Okay, now I'm going to show you three people. Suhas Patil from IIT Kharagpur, later he went to MIT. He was the first PhD student of Amar Bose. I'll talk about Amar Bose later. And then Prabhu Goyal from IIT Kanpur. Then he went to CMU, he joined IBM. Rajveer Singh from Roorkee. And then he in fact worked in TIFR for a couple of years, and then he went to California. These three people, and there are a couple of more, they did a wonderful work which sort of changed the face, contributed to the evolution, because this is very important. Nowadays we are not living in the age of Edison and Graham Bell where one inventor could invent a technology. Now every technology has thousands of people collaborating and contributing to it. So we cannot talk about any father or mother of any technology anymore. So it's only you can talk about significant contribution. So these three and some others, Indians, contributed significantly to the evolution of what are today called EDA tools, electronic design automation tools. It is these tools which are made possible that design can be done in Pune or Hubli or Hyderabad or Bangalore, Delhi, Bombay, of a chip, of a cutting-edge chip. It can be designed here, it can be tested here, and it can be fabricated in China or Malaysia or Korea, Japan, wherever. Okay, so all of us used to lament in the 60s, 70s, 80s that India has missed the electronic bus, right? But we seem to have caught the same bus at a later stop. Because of this evolution of technology, that there is a separation of fabrication and design. So today you have what are called fabless chip companies. Some people call them fabless chip companies also. Okay, and because interestingly, if you look at the economics of chip industry, 80% of the value is in design and testing. Only 20% is in fabrication. So with all the strength of hardware industry we talk about in East Asia, it is actually the low end of the chip industry. The leading today, the leading countries are, other than United States, Israel and India. These are the three countries which are doing where cutting edge design is being done. And that is the reason every chip company in the world today has their design and R&D centers in India. Intel, Motorola, TSMC, even Huawei, you know, ZTE, everybody is here. Okay. And there are a couple of smaller Indian-owned, Indian-started companies also, but a lot of Indians working. But the EDA tools which have made this possible. Atik Raza, another doyen of chip industry. It was his technology and leadership which started as a startup called NextGen. And again, a lot of Indians worked in that. Thomas Thumpy had started that, then Rajveer Singh and several others worked in that. It was funded by Vinod Khosla, and that NextGen was acquired later by AMD. And AMD is one of the also RANs, used to be called as also RANs in the chip industry, right? Intel was here and AMD was here. But when AMD acquired NextGen, and with Atik Raza's leadership, AMD came close to Intel and even challenged Intel in certain years in the processor industry. And that's due to Raza's leadership. And Atik Raza, of course, is a Pakistani. And you know that in technology and in many other fields, there is no Indo-Pak problem. He's a great friend of India. He comes to India often. And he has given also breaks to many Indians in his companies, etc. This is Vinod Dham. You might have heard of him. He was part of Intel team, which led to the development of Pentium. Pentium, till today, is the largest selling chip ever. And he's from Delhi College of Engineering. And there's an interesting story Vinod Dham told me. By the way, Vinod Dham, before he went abroad, went to California, he was working in a small semiconductor company in India. It was one of the few semiconductor companies in India which actually created components in the 60s. It was called Continental Devices. I don't know how many people remember that. And Continental Devices was owned by Sardarji, I forget his name, Gurpreet Singh or something like that. And so Gurpreet Singh told him, Dham later, that in 1969, Robert Noyce, who knew Gurpreet Singh, came and stayed with him for 15 days. And every day he'll go to Government of India and plead with them to allow him to set up the Intel's first fabrication lab outside of California. For 15 days he lobbied, and he found the government not responsive. And that's how India lost the first cutting-edge chip thing. He went to Malaysia and established it later there. Anyway, so those were different days. Vinod Khosla from IIT Delhi, electrical engineering, but he moved to biomedical when he went to CMU, Carnegie Mellon. And then from there, when he went to California, he wanted to start, actually he wanted to get into chip design. So he started a small company called Daisy Systems. But then they found that even if you create the you know, framework, excuse me. Even if you find you create the platform to do this chip design, that you don't have powerful enough computers which can in which you can actually do the design. So he said, now we have to build these computers, which were called workstations later. So he, along with three others, started a new company called Sun Micro. And you know what heights Sun Micro went to. Of course, today Sun Micro doesn't exist. That is the nature of computer industry. And so he was one of the founders of this Sun Micro Systems. And later, he exited Sun Micro and became a leading venture capitalist. Even today, he's highly respected. He'll always in the top 10 or something like that. He appears as a venture capitalist, and he has funded, identified and funded many many new startups which later went on to become very big companies. Janak Patel, he's from Baroda MS University, and he's now, he's an academic, he teaches in University of Urbana, University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, and he worked out an algorithm to test a chip, because you know, if a chip, designed chip, if it fails its functionality, it's a big loss. So before you go to casting, right when you design it, if you can create a software which can test whether the design will deliver the required functionality, then that will save you a lot of cost, and you can redesign it and so on. So it is his algorithms which are being used by Intel and Motorola and all the leading chip companies. Okay, so that is, I am just showing a smattering of this in various fields. This is what I call a psychotech. That is when mathematics and engineering reach a certain limit, and then you can't carry it further than that in whatever you are trying to achieve. It could be compression ratios, it could be, you know, audio signals, video signals, whatever it is in signal processing. Then what do? You have limited bandwidth. Bandwidth, there is always a problem of bandwidth. And so this is where the consumer psychology could come to assistance. If you study consumer psychology, after all, how does a consumer perceive this? You know, after all, it's not a machine. If it is a machine getting data transfer from another machine, there is one problem. If a human being is receiving the data from a machine, then how does a human being react? So this is a very, very important thing. So that is why from the very beginning, psychologists have played an extremely important role in the development of modern technology. The person who seeded the idea of ARPANET, that is, computers should communicate with each other, and ARPANET became the basic data communication network developed in the 60s and 70s, which later led to the development of internet, was actually a psychologist. His name was J.C.R. Licklider. He funded, he was part of DARPA, and he funded the evolution of the data communication networks. The person, and his assistant, Bob Taylor, who carried on from him, was also a psychologist, psychophysicist, they used to be called. And then he was drafted by Xerox to lead their venture in PARC, in Palo Alto Research Center. And it's PARC that created the PC. PARC created the mouse. PARC created the Windows. PARC created the laser printer. Literally, PARC created the PC. Of course, IBM and Apple took advantage of that. Microsoft took advantage of that. Even word processing was invented in PARC. So all this was done under the leadership of Bob Taylor, who was a psychologist. Okay. Same thing with artificial intelligence. You know, Simon Newell, all that in CMU, they were psychologists. In fact, Simon got a Turing Award in computer science. He also got, I think, Nobel in economics, right? So there is a lot of interaction between, which we forget. In all our tech companies and engineering and all that, we think hard science. And in fact, we don't teach any soft sciences. We don't even teach biology, forget about soft sciences. So very recently that they are talking about biology and engineering. And so here I'll give you three examples. First one is Amar Bose himself. Amar Bose, of course, his father was Indian. He was born in America. His father had a very interesting career. His father, Noni Gopal Bose, was a revolutionary. And when he was being chased by British CID to escape them, he jumped into a ship in Calcutta Harbor, and that landed up in the United States. And that's how he went to US. And he married an American there. And but Amar Bose, of course, remembered a lot of stories from those days. He used to say that there was still an underground revolutionaries network, you know, So they used to come and visit his father and all that, and he said, when I was a child, I used to hear people coming and talking in the kitchen table, you know, and when we were all sleeping, and talking about what happened in Jallianwala Bagh and what happened here, there and all that. So he had some emotional linkages, but then later he had a actual linkage also, that his PhD guide was a brilliant but very enigmatic mathematician called Norbert Wiener at MIT. And nobody could understand what Norbert Wiener was talking. So literally all the faculty in MIT doubly pushed Amar Bose, saying you do PhD under him. So Amar Bose said, for 2 years I didn't understand what this guy was talking. So I was ready to give up, and they said, no, you better stick to him, because we don't understand what he is doing. So at least, you know, you will understand. So then he said, one day, final day, suddenly something like a revelation came to me, and after that I understood everything he was doing. And then we carried on gloriously, and he finished his PhD. And Norbert Wiener was a great friend of India. Interestingly, apparently he wanted to migrate to India, and for some stupid reason he didn't get the visa or something like that. Okay. So he told Amar Bose that after his PhD, that he said, okay, you'll get a faculty position in MIT, but you take off 1 year and go to India. So Amar Bose came to India. He spent 6 months in ISI with Mal Nobis in Calcutta, because his work was also stochastic process in electrical circuits and so on. So he interacted with ISI in a statistical institute in Calcutta, and then 6 months with Krishnan in National Physical Laboratory in Delhi, lectured here and there, and then he went back. But in the process, see, Amar Bose was a great music enthusiast. He himself used to play, I think, violin very well. And so he was very curious. He, in his spare time, he had bought at that time what was called a hi-fi system. Hi-fi meant high fidelity, right? Today hi-fi means something else. Array, both hi-fi hai. So high fidelity, but he found that if you listen to a concert music in a concert hall and then you take it home and then you play it on your hi-fi player, it's not the same. So there is no fidelity. So why is that? So he kept taking it out, and you know, because he grew up, his father had a small radio repair shop in Philadelphia. So he had grown up, you know, repairing radios and this and that and so on. So he took apart his hi-fi system and checked its amplifier, everything, all linear response, everything was fine. So he said, then what is wrong? Why it's not producing it? So that is when he thought of this, that he, I don't know what led him to that, but he started getting into psychoacoustics. He said, how do they perceive music? And it is based on those results, those revolutionary Bose speakers were designed, you know. And MIT went out of its way and allowed him to start a company while being in the part of the faculty. And within a couple of decades, today, you know, the biggest audio brand is Bose, not Philips, not Sony, it is Bose. And anyway, he went on to do many other revolutionary things. His last thing he did was suspension system for a car, okay, based on it's called an electrodynamic suspension system, so that doesn't matter what type of a road, what type of a surface you're going on, you'll absolutely not feel any jerk or jolt. So I don't know when that is going to come into auto industry. It took quite some time for his Bose system to come into autos and concert halls and so on. Anyway, so this was the first example of actually, and later he gave a course in psychoacoustics, and people say, and I wrote a tribute to him later after he passed away, and many of his students even came to my blog and reported that it was the most popular course in MIT for decades. And in the big lecture hall, there was not even standing space, they say, for his courses. He was such a popular lecturer. He also taught many other courses in electrical engineering, but his most popular course was on psychoacoustics. Arun Netravali from Bombay, in fact product of Bombay's municipal schools, not any hi-fi school, from municipal school, here I am using hi-fi in the other sense, and went to IIT Bombay, went to Rice for his PhD, then joined Bell Labs. And it is the group under him, he was in signal processing, and he also headed the standard setting groups, which set the standards for JPEG and MPEG 2, MPEG 4 and all that, all the audio, video and still camera, still picture standards. Then it is his team which developed the HDTV. And again here in television transmission, how can we do high quality television transmission with low bandwidth? And this was all done in 70s, by the way. Most of the work in Bell Labs was done in, cutting edge work was done in 70s. And that time there was not even a good chip industry. And all you had was AT&T lines which could carry 64 kbps, you know, that was called toll qualities, you know, toll quality, you know, trunk voice you can hear. So, and they found that they need at least 70 mbps to carry video signal. So how do you do video transmission with low bandwidth? This was an issue. So again they used perception studies, and that's what led to HDTV. You can Google him and read some of his papers, cutting edge papers on signal processing and what work he did. And they said we need a good platform to demo it to the world. So they chose Los Angeles Olympics in 1984 to demo their HDTV. And of course nobody remembers 1984 Olympics for HDTV. If at all they remember, anyone of you remember 84 Olympics? What for?
Well, it was one of the best, I think, as the Americans claimed in Los Angeles.
That is true, but why? It is historical.
We had, I think, probably, Russia did not participate in. We had color television by then in India for us.
Okay. Yeah, we have a reason to remember it because P.T. Usha lost the bronze by 0.001 second. But the world remembers it for Carl Lewis, who won 4 gold medals in athletics. He's the first human being to win 4 gold medals in athletics. Okay, but nobody remembers HDTV. It was demoed at that point. But it took another nearly 20 years for it to appear on our, in our homes. That is because of politics. Because technology, to come to the marketplace, it's not enough to have good technology. It's not enough to, you know, because there are multi-billion dollar industries and they have to accept that technology. Broadcasters have to accept it, the receiver, TV makers have to accept it, channels have to accept it, and so on and so forth. And in this whole game, audio, video, etc., there are 3 major blocks. There is Japan on one side, there is Europe on another side, and United States on the third side. India, China didn't count at that time. Now China is getting into the picture with 5G and so on. Okay, so these 3 blocks used to like arbitrarily set different standards. So you might have heard about VHS and Betamax wars, right? And it happened with CDs also. Philips had its own CD, Sony had its own CD, you know, different standards. And it happened with TV also. So TV, you know, PAL and NTSC and CCAL and so on. So everybody had their own. In mobile phones, you had that problem. Your GSM phone only worked in Europe. It didn't work in the United States. They had CDMA. And both didn't work in Japan. They had PCS. Right? So, and all of them finally converged in 3G and then 4G. So there is no problem now. But, and same thing happened with the TV. So finally, it took another 10, 15 years for all the TV conglomerates, Europe, Japan and United States, to get together and form the standards, and that's how HDTV took so long to come. But anyway, but there's just a lesson that technology is not enough. There's politics, signal, and especially in standards issue. And that's what is going on between US and China now about 5G. Nikhil Jayant, IISc, went to Bell Labs, and it is his team which finally led to the development of MP3. Of course, the patent is owned by a person from Fraunhofer, I think, institutes. But he also came and worked here in Bell Labs during that time. And what he is demonstrating here is that they found that in sound, high quality sound, if you want to stream it with low bandwidth, how do you do it? Mathematics and engineering, all the signal processing had reached a limit. Beyond that, you could not do. So if you want to have CD quality sound, which was at that time considered the standard, you know, so that to be streamed at low bandwidth, how do you do it? You have to compress it more, but you had reached the limits. Then they did psychoacoustic studies, perception studies, and they found that human ear cannot hear 90% of the frequencies which are in their signal. It is not sensitive to 90% of those frequencies. So if you can identify those frequencies and filter them out, right away you have a factor of 10 compression. And that is the basic funda of this MP3. So again, it is a product of psychoacoustics and technology getting together. Okay. Now look at fiber optics and networking. Fiber optics, this is one piece where we can say he is the father of fiber optics. This is one instance, at least in modern thing. Narinder Singh Kapani, the Sardarji from Dehradun, he always dreamed when he was a physics student that can I bend light, you know, can I make light go through a curved trajectory. And he had thought of all these complicated, maybe why not use prisms and all that, you know, complicated prism structures. Then he got a scholarship, he went to Imperial College to do his PhD in physics. And there in 1951, he worked on this problem. He said, I want to work on this problem. The advisor said, all right. So he said, I want to draw these glass fibers. And then through that, I want to send signal and see if it reaches the other end. So how do you draw glass fibers? Imperial College had no with this thing. So he went to a glass company called Pinkerton. But the Pinkerton was used to making glass bottles for beer. Okay, so they were making it with green and, you know, mostly green glass. So he went and told them, I want optical glass and I want you to draw fibers of that. First of all, they didn't understand what is optical glass. Okay, so he went through a lot of hassle, as you, many of you, if you are in experimental physics, you will know. And so he produced that. And of course, the problem with the glass fibers is that if you actually put a light source at one end, it can diffuse out of the boundaries. It's a cylinder and it can come out of the surface, right? So what do you do? So he thought of this idea of coating. So of course, you know all about total internal reflection and all that. So graded refractive index inside as you go out radially, etc., etc. Okay, and definitely at the interface, give a coating on the surface, etc. So he was finally able to send some light from one end of the fiber to the other. So his idea was that if you can bend it, so his first thought was medical. Can you put it into somebody's mouth and see what is going on inside his stomach? So you can say, if he, I mean, unfortunately, when the Nobel was given for fiber optics, few years back, it was given to Charles Kao, who used fiber optics to send, using lasers to send signals and laser communication. But at least I feel it, they should have shared the Nobel with him. After all, he discovered fiber optics. But he is one of the many like this. Like for example, even Jagdish Chandra Bose, his components were actually used by Marconi to build his radio. Radio, and Marconi got the Nobel, and Jagdish didn't even get to share it. And same thing happened with Kapani actually. He didn't share the Nobel on fiber optics. It was only given for communication part of it. But I think he should have at least been given a medical Nobel. After all, a lot of medical Nobels have been given to people who have discovered CAT scans and MRIs and, you know, all kinds of diagnostics and equipment and so on. Because today everybody uses endoscopy, laparoscopy, this scopy, that scopy, everywhere. They put all these fibers into your body and see what is going on and even carry on surgeries. Right? So that is Kapani. And in fact, in 1960, Scientific American asked him to write an article on it, and that's where he coined the word fiber optics. So he's truly the father of fiber optics. Desh Deshpande, Gururaj Deshpande, his pet name is Desh. So he did a lot of work. He started, he's from IIT Madras and then went to Queen's in Canada and then joined Motorola. So he started working on data communication. And his first major project was to increase the power of Motorola modems from 2.4 kbps to 9.6 kbps. That was big deal. Don't forget, even when TIFR had ERNET, it was 2.4 kbps. And first when it became 9.6 in 93 or 94, that too when VSNL brought this thing, it was a big thing. Okay, and then of course 14.4 you needed for the web, minimum 14.4 or 56. And later he went on to build many companies, and one of them was Sycamore, and before that another one, all into multiple optical networking, you know, where you have gigabytes and terabytes going and optically switching, etc. In fact, now he's a venture capitalist and he's gotten into a lot of other philanthropy, etc. But he has also started a startup which is quite successful in India, optical networking startup called Tejas Networks, based in Bangalore. Okay, now I'll look at internet. This is Abhay Bhushan from IIT Kanpur. He went to do his master's and PhD to MIT in 70-72. That time ARPANET was going on, so he got involved with ARPANET project. And he wrote the first specifications for email. So first email you can say was sent by Abhay Bhushan, and that was based on file transfer protocol FTP. Later of course SMTP became more common, and then the email is mostly based on SMTP. And after all the 2 years of work and all what all he had done, he tried to submit it to MIT. MIT said this is not worth a PhD, so poor guy dropped out after MS. Because all his work on ARPANET was not considered good enough. In fact, it happened to another person. I think Bob Metcalf also went through the similar problem, who later developed the Ethernet. And MIT refused. But Harvard gave him a PhD. So he said, it's okay. Later, gave him PhD. Pradeep Sindhu from IIT Kanpur. Then he went to CMU and then into Hawaii, and when he went to Hawaii he got involved in internet, because Hawaii was one of the leading centers of internet, and they were the first group which actually developed internet on wireless network. And in fact, appropriate to Hawaii, they called it AlohaNet. Aloha in Hawaiian, you know, is hello, welcome, right? And it also significantly, it meant one computer talking to the other computer and saying aloha. So you know, computers have to communicate to each other. So the first thing you say is hello, and then you say accept it. So there's a way transfer happens later once the protocol is set up. So that's what interested him in internet. So when he came back later, when he was working in he joined PARC in the 80s. And later he thought of this, that that time there was a big debate on what should be the basis of internet, and the most popular technology which was pushed by all the carriers like AT&T, etc., was what was called ATM, asynchronous time modulation. So he insisted on IP, and he created a whole system based on IP, and then he went to Vinod Khosla. Vinod Khosla said fine, good idea. So they started a company called Juniper Networks. And today, Juniper Networks, you know, is one of the biggest companies which has taken over all internet infrastructure, because all the high-end routers are made by Juniper Networks. And they had to deal with a big gorilla called Cisco. And they were able to survive and flourish. Yogen Dalal, very interesting, is an IIT Bombay graduate. Then he went to Stanford for his PhD. And at IIT Bombay, he wanted to work. That time, you know, IIT Bombay had one old Russian computer, right? Professor Isaac used to head the computer science department. And the most advanced computer at that time, everybody loved the TIFR computer. That time, I think it was CDC 3600. Or maybe 60, later they had upgraded to 66. But it was still not time sharing. So he was thinking, can I access it remotely? Because, you know, where is power and where is Colaba? You know, every day if he has to commute back and forth, you know, his half day will be gone. So he said, can I set up a terminal in Powai and connect it through telephone line to the TIFR computer and then talk to it? So Isaac said, okay, go ahead and do it. So that was his BTEC project. And like most BTEC projects, it didn't work. But then when he went to Stanford for his PhD, he kept networking was his passion. So he worked with Winton Cerf. So Winton Cerf, you might know as one of the, you can say, leading lights of internet technology. He became later that. So Winton Cerf, he and another graduate student called Carl Sunshine, three together worked on the method to connect different networks. See, you have multiple networks, local area networks, each one have their own set of computers, set on their own protocols, particular protocols and all that among themselves. Now, how do you connect them? How do you create a protocol which is neutral to all these things? And that is what is, that is what these people invented, which is called TCP/IP. So TCP/IP is a product of Yogendra Dalal, Carl Sunshine and Winton Cerf, which is the basis of all internet. Okay, AI, I just mention a few. First of all, first person to mention is Professor Narasimhan from TIFR. Professor Narasimhan should also be remembered. He was an applied mathematician. He was doing his PhD in US and he had come across a bit of theory, computing theory, which was just being developed by von Neumann and all that. And then Dr. Baba called him here and he said, in 54, he said, build a computer. So he had no knowledge of electronics. That way he was a mathematician. He gathered a few people. You might have heard this story recently. I think you had a celebration here. So anyway, they produced Tiffrac, which at one time was as good as any other computer in the world. Unfortunately, they couldn't test it for a year because there was no air conditioning in TIFR at that time. So 1 year the computer had to wait for air conditioning, but that was fine. But later he got into artificial intelligence, interestingly, because Baba gave him a very practical idea, practical problem. He said they were doing these cloud chamber experiments. So you have these tracks, you know. Now, when you see textbooks, we see very nice cloud chamber and bubble chamber tracks, right? Particles going, turning, left, right, annihilating, creating new particles, all that. But that is in two dimensions. The actual world is in three dimensions. So how do you convert three dimensions into two-dimensional pictures? So for that, you need to actually recognize the pattern and then convert it, project it to two dimensions. And that's how he got into pattern recognition and he became a leading contributor to pattern recognition, which later came to be part of, major part of artificial intelligence. Raj Reddy, again, interesting person. He's a civil engineer and he's the only Indian who has won the Turing Award. Turing Award is like the Nobel Prize in computer science. Excuse me. So from here he went to Australia and then he landed up in Stanford in 61 or something like that. And there he got into artificial intelligence. And it's very interesting how they got into artificial intelligence. In 61, Stanford had started a project. The project was, suppose we go to Mars, okay, and leave a robot there to roam around on Martian surface. How will it find its way? How will it navigate all the rocks and craters and all that? So imagine this. 1961, the Russians had put Gagarin. The Americans were nowhere in space. They had no man in space. Forget about going to Mars. And here was a project which was talking about going to Mars and dropping a robo and how will the robo do. That is called actually blue sky research. Right? And what came out of it was a lot of development in artificial intelligence, computer vision, and so on. So he contributed to computer vision, later speech analysis. Excuse me. Arvind Joshi, another Dayan, for almost 50 years he's worked in computational linguistics. That is, how do you make computers understand natural languages? We all know computers understand computer languages and they are very neat. Computer languages are precise. But natural languages are full of ambiguities. So how will you disambiguate? How will you teach machine to disambiguate? What a two-year child can do, a two-year child, one-year child can understand what the mother is saying and all the nuances of it. what is the tone she is using, you know, is she angry, is she playful, is she just, you know, just giving him an order or whatever. She, the tone, the face, everything is able to find out, and without any precise definition. Come here. It doesn't say GPS coordinates of here. For a machine, you have to give GPS coordinates of here. Here doesn't mean anything to a computer. Come here means what? Right? So leave alone Sachin Tendulkar hitting Shoaib Akhtar for a sixer. It took about 30 milliseconds for ball to leave Shoaib Akhtar's hand. He was bowling at 160 kilometers per hour in 2003 World Cup, to leave his hand and reach Tendulkar's bat. And Tendulkar's motor nerves could respond, his brain could process, his nerves could respond, and not only play the ball but hit it for a six. We don't have a robo or a supercomputer which can do that. Okay, so even on, at a physical level, forget about intelligence, other aspects of intelligence. So anyway, I take that attitude. Many, there may be other evangelists of AI, but AI, once Bob Taylor told me, we have not reached the intelligence of a cockroach with all these billions of dollars spent on AI. Of course, AI can do many other things which we cannot do, repetitive work and high speed work and even pattern recognition and some amount of learning, but not ambiguity, where you are faced with ambiguity. Anyway, so after 50 years, I asked him when I met, what are you doing now? He said, we are observing 1 year olds and 2 year olds. How do they understand their parents? After all, we can't put electrodes in their heads because no parent will allow it. So we're trying to observe them in daycare centers and so on. Anyway, now I come to this, almost coming to the end of it. What is this about Indian software industry? So I want to mention three people in terms of software engineering: F.C. Kohli, Ram Dorai, and Keshav Nuri. Keshav Nuri is IIT Bombay, then Carnegie Mellon. He worked in TIFR, of course, IIT Kanpur, TIFR. Now, what, and there are others also in the industry who contributed to it, but these were the people who worked in 60s and 70s and created the standards and quality and so on systems in what I was talking about earlier. Cars were being made before Henry Ford. They were called quadricycles. That means in a workshop, in a single workshop, all the mechanics used to gather together and make a car. So they used to make 4 or 5 cars in a year. Okay. Henry Ford's, his genius and his method of thinking was that to create an assembly line to divide the whole process into several simpler processes. But the thing was, make sure, so if one person is only drilling a hole and other person is putting the screw and the hole should match, no? He should have the right screw and that should be, the hole should have the right diameter. So you have to, if you want to build something modularly and assemble them modularly, they should fit perfectly. So for that, there have to be standards. And only then you can industrialize a process. Otherwise, in the 60s, we had great programmers. Even today, we have great programmers. Okay, we call them coders and all that. So these programmers, I mean, you might take a lot of shortcuts, you may be genius, you know, you might do something but the other guy can't understand. His method of thinking is different from your method of thinking. He can't debug your program. Later tomorrow some feature has to be added. Then he has to understand your logic, he doesn't understand your logic. So standardization of programming methods. So this is what is called componentization in borrowing from manufacturing into services. That's componentization of this whole programming. And so each group creates a component and then the components are brought together and modularly they are assembled. And they are supposed to fit perfectly and again deliver the results required. So that requires perfect standard setting. So today what we call all these CMM level 3, 4, 5 and all that, those levels are basically measured based on this type of methodologies, whether these methodologies are followed or not. So in the early 70s, these gentlemen got involved with IEEE and others in actually creating those standards for software engineering. So that is what has led to today India dominating software development in the world. So it's not because Indians produce cheap computer engineers. In fact, China produces more computer engineers than India. But no Chinese company is bigger than Noisoft, which has about 20,000 engineers. That's it. What they have, others are e-commerce companies, Tencent and Alibaba and these types of people. But actually, software development is very weak. In fact, that is the reason Chinese government is welcoming all Indian companies to come and set it up there. They are even giving free office space and all that sort of thing, you know, real estate, because they have built up huge cities empty and say, please come and set it up. Only you train our people. Your managers can be yours, but you train Chinese people. This is what they are saying. And there is a very high turnover also, which means they are taking them out and putting them in somewhere else. Okay. Not that they are unhappy, but actually it's a government organized, well organized affair. So this is the reason, the whole methodology of project management, first of all this software engineering, okay, industrialized development of software. So today thousands of people can work on one project, not on one genius, thousands of people. And today you have at least 4 or 5 companies which are more than 1 lakh. In fact, TCS today is the largest company in the world with 4 lakh engineers. Can you imagine that? It's you know, it's bigger than IBM and so on. And they can do very large projects because of this method they developed. And not only that, that has fully, it's not just 1 or 2 companies. That ability has is all over India. That is the reason IBM comes here, PwC comes here, KPMG comes here, Morgan Stanley comes here, everybody comes here and sets up their software development. And IBM, they don't advertise it much because it's bad publicity for them in the US. In fact, when Modiji went to New York recently, you must have seen New York Times had a half page welcome ad by IBM. IBM welcomes PM Narendra Modi. Why? What is the connection? Because IBM has more people in India than in US. Okay, they don't want to advertise it because there may be backlash in America. But why? Because IBM finds ready-made people here with those skills, from beginning trainee to mid-level management to senior level executives, you know, who can handle large projects. So everybody, Accenture, IBM, everybody wants to come here because of this whole infrastructure that has been created. It's not because of cheap labor or labor arbitrage of something. That's why some of the most complex systems are being done here, engineering design, you know, and all kinds of applications. It's not even just, originally it used to be some enterprise software. Now it is into everything. So literally you are in the heart of the global industry, and particularly US industry, and to a large extent European industry now. But in the US industry, markets, banks, stock exchanges, corporates, everywhere it is Indian software engineers which are doing work for them, fixing it or developing it. And it has become necessary part of the global ecosystem. Okay, now I'll briefly talk about telecom. This is a very interesting case actually of Paul Raj. You might, okay. Paul Raj is a Indian Navy officer. Today he holds a maximum number of patents in 4G. He's an emeritus professor in Stanford in telecom. You might have heard him sometime. Has he come here? Yeah, excellent. Okay. Sam Pitroda, of course, you heard. His switch. He had patents in switch, and he brought he came here and convinced Mrs. Gandhi and later Rajiv Gandhi that we can do it in India. And that's how C.dot switch came into being. And C.dot switch, even today, this is surprising, that it is a highest used switch anywhere in the world. Because there are many countries which are using C.dot switches all over the world, especially developing world. And because it's ideal for a small exchange, you know, people say 5,000 to 10,000 people. Now, if you want 100,000 people or 1 million people, very large exchanges, then you have to work on it. But 10,000 people and above, so you can create a lot of digital networks based on this. So that digitization, actually, there were two. If you want to know about IT revolution in India, it is C.dot and ISRO, which created the telecom infrastructure on which the IT could develop, both IT internally and then for exports. And BSNL, of course, because it gave the international connectivity. Bishnu Atal from IISc went to Bell Labs, did fantastic work in signal processing. Again, he thought totally out of the box, and his approach is what is being used for low bitrate transmissions, and mobile transmissions are very low bitrate. Okay, so 8 kbps, 16 kbps, you should get still good quality sound. And it is his coding method. It is called linear predictive coding, and which is used in literally every single mobile phone in the world. Manmohan Sondhi, another ISA product, went to Bell Labs. He created what are called echo cancellers, again, which are very important in telecom networks. It's a multi-billion dollar industry now. Rajendra Neera Singh, very interesting case. Neera is a chemical engineer. Rajendra is an electrical engineer. Both went to from IIT Kanpur. Both went to US, and in their pastime, they created a software for network planning, and they didn't know what to do with it. In that time, in 1980-81, US was opening up the cellular the licenses. So they said that AT&T, which actually created the cellular telephony, they said they already have a monopoly over landline, so they cannot bid. So then anybody and everybody could bid for it, even Panwalas bid for it. So, but they didn't know how to build the networks. So these people sent their software to one of the people who had got the license for Baltimore area, small area. And that fellow said, okay, how much money I should give you? The people said, we don't know. They said, what do you mean you don't know? He didn't want to be sued by these people. You know, Americans are always scared. Somebody will sue them later and all that. So they said, no, you better, you know, tell me how much I should pay. And okay, these people said $1,500. $1,500 was big time, big money that time. After all, PhD students used to get $200 as a, you know, assistantship. So they said $1,500. Then he said, okay, which company I should give a check to? Sir, we don't have any company. He said, then go and create a company. So they created a company called LCC. LCC stands for Lunaj Communication Consulting. Lunaj is a small village in Rajasthan from which Rajendra Singh comes. Okay, and within 10-15 years, by mid-90s, 80% of all the mobile networks in North America were designed by LCC. And by 96, both of them were on the Forbes billionaire list. So they were also successful businessmen and at the same time technologists. Databases, I just mentioned one person, Nand Das, who was the chief scientific officer of Oracle, which you all know, the largest database company. Relational databases. VFX, this is a very interesting person. This is Balamanian. He's a mechanical engineer from Madras who went to Rochester to study optics. And there, after his PhD in 73-74, he thought of this actually medical problem, biomedical problem, that X-ray films, can they be digitized and then sent over telephone lines, and then using that file, can they recreate, print that on a film? So film to digital, digital to film. No, suddenly two companies' antennas went up in Hollywood. One was Pixar, other was Industrial Light and Magic. Both of them jumped on that technology and got the rights for it, and that's how you got Star Wars. So it is based on his technology that all most of the VFX which came into being, special effects in Hollywood, you can say are product of originally his patents and his technology. That's why he was the first Indian to be given an Oscar. In 98-99, he was given technical Oscar. And they were showing all behind all the films which were using special effects. And he lost his eye in his childhood. His brother also of Mr. Wagul, I don't know how many of you know, ICSA chairman, former ICSA chairman. Okay, theoretical computer science. I'm just going to skim through a few people who are absolutely top-notch performers in theoretical computer science, which hardly any computer scientist understands. It's mostly pure mathematics. Ravi Kannan from IIT Bombay, who was at Yale for a long time, Cornell and Yale. Now he's back in India at the Microsoft Research. Rajiv Motwani, IIT Kanpur, who was at Stanford, unfortunately passed away very prematurely. In fact, there are three, four prizes which are very important recognitions of work in theoretical computer science. Gödel Prize, Fulkerson Prize, Nevan-Lena Prize. So the individuals I'm showing have won all those prizes. Okay, so these are the top people in theoretical computer science. Rajiv Motwani got the Gödel Prize, and he also wrote the original paper with Sergey Brin and Page, which created Google. So he's a guru. They were his graduate students, not his students, but they were students in the department. They used to come to him for advice and money for their servers. So finally, they moved out of the campus and set up Google separately. And so he continued till the end as a technical advisor for Google. This is Narendra Karmarkar, you must have heard of him. He was associated with TFR, he came back, he's in Pune. Karmarkar algorithm changed linear programming in a revolutionary way in the 80s. Umesh Vajirani is a pioneer in quantum computing. Now he's at Berkeley from IIT Delhi. Earlier, Madhusudan, Umesh's student, he's now at MIT, he has got the Nevan Leina Prize also. Sanjeev Arora, another Umesh's student, who is now at Princeton, he's also got, I think, the Fulkerson Prize now. I think he solved that traveling salesman problem, I think, recently. Lau Grover from IIT Delhi, he created the Grover algorithm in quantum computing again, was at Bell Labs. Manindra Agarwal, he's a Pakka Desi product, BTech, MTech, PhD from IIT Kanpur, and you must have heard of him, you might have seen him. He and his two students, BTech students, in fact, created history when they solved a 300-year-old problem. And not only that, their work hit the headlines of New York Times. Scientists are fortunate enough to hit the headlines of New York Times. And control theory, Vidyasagar, you might have heard of him. From Madras, then he went to Waterloo. He's a doyen of control theory, several books on it. He was brought back to India by Abdul Kalam as lab, DRDO lab was set up for him called CARE in Bangalore, Center for Artificial Intelligence and Robotics. And it is his group actually which solved the most difficult problem in Tejas LCA, light combat aircraft, which was to create the control surface for it. Okay, it is because it's an unstable fourth generation fighter, so you needed a very complicated control surface. It is his group created it. Now he's back in India. Satellite communication, Pradman Kaul from Bombay, later went to Berkeley. Played a major role in the creation of VSAT technology. Later, he recently retired as the chairman of Hughes Network Systems. And you know, we use VSATs everywhere, ATMs, markets, stock markets, everywhere. Storage, Praveen Chaudhary from IIT Delhi, later headed IBM research and later was a director of Brookhaven National Laboratory. His research led to magneto-optic memory. He was given the President's Medal for Science in the US. Information theory, Tom Kailath, you must have heard of him, outstanding work in Stanford University, earlier from Pune Engineering College. Okay, this is the face of my book, Science of Silicon. This is the other book I wrote about TCS, research being done in TCS. In fact, I have a copy of that. I would like to give it to TIFR Library. Yes. Yeah, this is it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, so that's it.
Politely keep on asking him to speed up. I'm sure we will have many more.